Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
For months, global headlines have been dominated by harrowing images and emotional reports of suffering in Gaza, particularly around the issue of starvation. And yet, when similar evidence emerged in the form of a shocking video, actually two videos, of Israeli hostages emaciated and near death after months and, nearly 2 years in Hamas captivity, the media response was a whisper. If that, why the double standard? Why are Gazans humanized while Israeli hostages are often sidelined and politicized? Joining me is Adam Levick, his editor of Camera UK, a leading media watchdog focused on accurate and fair coverage of Israel and the Middle East. A very good morning to you. Thank you for joining us. Adam, how do you interpret the media's vastly different coverage of starvation amongst Gazans versus the hostages held by Hamas?
Yeah, so to answer your question, we'd have to go back to October of 2023 in the first couple weeks of the war after the Hamas atrocity, which murdered 1,200 men, women, and children, taking 250 hostage. At the time, we were monitoring the media in real time, as we do every day, and we noticed as early as a week or two into the war, and this is an important caveat, before the IDF even launched its ground invasion, the whatever sympathetic coverage Israel had received in the media was beginning to wane. And what we saw at the time was a counter campaign by Hamas, pro-Hamas groups, by groups that are institutionally anti-Israel, to turn the narrative around from one about the worst anti-Semitic atrocity since the Holocaust to one about Israel engaging in disproportionate force and engaging in ethnic cleansing and or genocide against the Palestinians. Now, I want to reiterate this, because this is quite astonishing. This campaign, this narrative began to take shape online, at least, and in certain media outlets such as The Guardian and others, 10 days to 2 weeks after the massacre, when they were still in finding traces of once were full intact human Israeli bodies in southern communities in Israel. I think the context of the failure to highlight the concentration camp evoking images of Eviatar David and to really make that the focal point of media coverage goes back to October. It goes back to a media landscape, a media ideological grip that simply doesn't allow them to portray Palestinians as anything other than victims and as Israelis anything other than oppressors. So it simply isn't in their interest to highlight the savagery of Hamas any more than they absolutely have to.
Part of me thinks that maybe a timeline would be a very good way of illustrating this. In other words, a couple of days afterwards, this is the statement, this is what happened in the papers. Have we looked, there seems to be a bit of an echo on your side. Is your radio on perhaps? Because it is coming back to me a little bit. It sounds a bit better now. But the question is, if you are still there, are you there with us, Adam? Adam, can you just check that you're not muted again? And then let's just see if that is any better. That definitely sounds better. So would a timeline help? Would that be able to illustrate just how? Because what I find is that what we're doing, and I do the same, I look at our local press over the weekend and I say, what a disgrace that you didn't cover or barely mentioned the hostages and the way in which they're being treated and these videos. But it's just, it almost doesn't give perspective. It just calls it out at the moment, and then people roll their eyes and say, yeah, you Zionist, you're only sympathetic towards towards Jewish suffering. You're not sympathetic towards anything else, and they move on. But I wonder if there's a way where you guys who are tracking it can zoom out and look at coverage in that way. Is it possible to do that, and is it even helpful?
Well, let me answer that very good question in several ways. Number one, that the pure volume of content that we have to follow and have to read and have to contextualize is enormous. And that, you know, since October 7, 2023, the amount of Israel and Palestinian related content, particularly anti-Israel content, has been beyond anyone's capacity to keep track of. Having said that, we do zoom out sometimes. In fact, you know, the what I mentioned to you about the Guardian's coverage of Israel in the aftermath of October 7th was a zoom out, in that I looked at like a few weeks in October, and I, you know, I tracked like in real time the swift evolution from mildly sympathetic coverage to demonizing rhetoric, falsely accusing Israel of ethnic cleansing and or genocide. You know, and as you know, that's an important window, because the genocide libel has, you know, taken off since then, and you know, it's widely used almost like as if it's a fact by certain media outlets. So, you know, we zoomed out and we saw that the genocide libel began weeks after, less than 2 weeks after the massacre. And there are other posts. I'm working on a post right now about the campaign, the Hamas, what we have traced as a Hamas campaign since late July of, you know, 2025, to promote the starving children in Gaza narrative, which they use conveniently after they effectively walked out of talks between the U.S. and Qatar over what would have been a 60-day ceasefire and the release of many hostages and an increase of aid. So this campaign by Hamas, I'm about to show in a post I'll publish later today, began in late July because they didn't want to agree to a deal, because they thought that there was better PR value in photos of their citizens.
Well, they're right.
Emaciated,
I think they're right.
Than actually an increase. Yeah, they are right. And sadly, you know, much of the international community fell for it, and they started condemning Israel. And Hamas, sensing that they had the PR advantage, decided to, you know, to go with it. They decided to push it full throng, and it was successful. And it even turned out to work so well that countries like the UK and France and others who were on the fence about Palestine state recognition announced that they were going to recognize a Palestinian state, due in large measure to the images, many of which were dishonest, many of which didn't actually show children that were starving to death from a lack of food, but had other comorbidities such as cerebral palsy, that this was manipulated and used in order to gain a huge diplomatic advantage for Hamas and disincentivize them from reaching an agreement. So the opposite of what the West claims that they wanted. So, you know, this piece will zoom out and give a kind of holistic 1 month snapshot of what happened to how we got to where we are now. And I think it's vital that people that support this, or even people that are open-minded, understand the cynical game that Hamas is playing. And that the cynical game works, that Western diplomats and, you know, foreign ministers and journalists and others fall for it. And that's one of the reasons the war is still going on.
A question I put to another guest earlier was that Hamas should have been the risk for Hamas in releasing these two videos of starving hostages, one digging his own grave, where we know that's theater because Hamas don't care whether he's buried or not, it's designed to torment. That should have been a major risk for Hamas, because anybody seeing that should be repulsed and should in fact question what this organization is about. And yet Hamas released both videos seemingly with the confidence of knowing that that wouldn't happen. How did we get here? How didn't it happen?
Well,
why can't media and people around the world see that and say, this doesn't make sense?
Well, I think that, you know, I'm not an expert in the, you know, but I'm following the war for the past 2 years and following media coverage of Israel and Hamas for the past 15 years. I think it's clear that Hamas's audience was a weary Palestinian, weary Israeli public, meaning they were hoping that those images would kind of wear down the Israeli spirit and make them more likely to pressure the government to end the war on terms that are more favorable for Hamas. So I think those videos can be seen and should be seen as an act of psychological warfare against not just the Israeli families of the hostages, but of the Israeli public in general. So, you know, so that's a separate question, right? So that public relations campaign, I think, was more directed towards Israel. And I think they assumed, and rightly, that to whatever degree the Western response of outrage would occur as a result of that concentration camp-evoking photo and video, that it would be muted. In other words, that, you know, the international community, as it were, or the West, wouldn't show the same outrage towards Hamas in showing that horrible video as they do towards Israel. And I think, you know, my post later today is going to show that they're right, that, you know, the West just simply, you know, put out pro forma statements condemning it, but there's been no pressure on Hamas, no extra pressure on Hamas to release the hostages. And so, you know, Hamas basically won that public relations war, not due to anything, you know, Israel did or didn't do, but just because there's an extremely, extremely dangerously gullible segment of Western society that is willing to go along and willing to, you know, willing to fail to see the difference between a Jewish progressive democracy and an Islamist death cult.
Towards the beginning of the war, Israel was very circumspect in releasing a lot of the videos and the horror of what was seen in the aftermath of October 7th. And it did it for many reasons, including protecting the dignity of the victims. I asked Douglas Murray the question as to, you know, if he thought that was the right decision. He said yes, because Israel shouldn't have had to prove what they already knew. It was just what everybody knew. It was almost gratuitous. But at the same time, I keep wondering if it wasn't a fundamental error at the time to assume that the world would have been as horrified by what was happening without the visuals, without the real visuals, than was hoped. Do you think that was a mistake?
Well, I think there's several factors to answer your question. Number one, they did put out an unedited 45-minute video for members of the media, for international diplomats.
Yes.
That I didn't see, but by all accounts, it was gruesome and disgusting and horrifying and every bit as repulsive as, you know, we would expect. But I do think that, you know, in a democratic society, they felt that they had to honor the privacy and the wishes of the families. So, you know, again, Israel being a Western democratic country, they have limitations on the decisions they can make by virtue of the fact that they're accountable to the victims and the rest of the Israeli public. However, I do think that, you know, I recall there were certainly plenty of horrifying videos put out on X, on Twitter, and other social, and Telegram, and other social media platforms. So, you know, those of us that scour social media each day to see what's going on in the Middle East, you know, there were some just shocking and traumatizing photos and videos that, you know, will be embedded in our heads, those of us who have seen it for forever. So there wasn't a shortage of shocking videos, I guess what I'm saying is the 45-minute film, I kind of wish that that was released to the public. I wish it was on YouTube, but I think they were just trying to respect, respect the family.
No, there's no doubt about that. There is no doubt, and maybe what you're saying is there was enough horrifying stuff that if you chose to see it, or if you chose to open your heart to Israeli or Jewish suffering, you would have been you would have done so. It wouldn't have made a difference. You didn't need more. So the role of organizations like CAMRA playing, holding journalists and editors to account, how much are they listening? How much will the UK press, for example, take note of some of the concerns and observations that you have raised?
Well, you know, as you know, Howard, you know, we focus a lot of our efforts on getting corrections, right? And it's not a perfect thing when you get a correction, but it does hold them accountable, and it does warn them that we're paying attention to every word that they write, every word that they say in broadcast. And, you know, the past 2 years, we've hit a record in terms of prompting over 600 corrections, many of which have been in the British media, many of which have been in other Western media outlets. And, you know, we like to look at it this way, you know, that's not winning the public relations war, but it's kind of making it's to the advantage of the Israeli and Jewish and pro-Israel community that they are being kept accountable, even though it's not sufficient. So we continue to focus on getting corrections. In fact, we've gotten hundreds upon hundreds of corrections in BBC Arabic. And as you know, BBC Arabic is one of the most influential outlets in the world in terms of their reach within the Middle East, in terms of, you know, it has the BBC logo, so people assume it's accurate. We think that we have, even though, you know, it's hard to measure, right? We are convinced that continuing to push back, continuing to hold them accountable, continuing to contact them and impress upon them that they're violating their own ethical standards is one way, not the only way, but one way to fight back. And we will not give up. We will continue to do that on top of other things, on top of our social media campaigns, on top of our very active presence on Instagram, X, and Facebook, and now I think even TikTok. So we have a multi-pronged way of fighting back. And I understand the frustration by those in the diaspora who want to see us, you know, really go for the jugular. And we sometimes do, but we've been around since 1982, and I think we have a very successful strategy. But what we're facing in this Hamas public relations campaign, accepted by too much of the West, is unprecedented, right? We're fighting a battle that is, you know, really just unprecedented in its coordination and in its malice towards not just Israel, but for Jews in the diaspora. So, you know, we are fighting back with all the tools we have, and we'll continue to do so. But unfortunately, there's no magic bullet.
That is where we leave it. Thank you for that and the work that you do. Adam Levick, editor of CAMRA UK.